Hello, and welcome to this episode of Human Rights Magazine. My name is Derek McCush. Many refugees are fleeing conflict or poverty, but many are also seeking to escape from a society in which, because of their sexual identity and or preference, they face violence and possibly death every day. In this episode of Human Rights Magazine, Julia Israel speaks with several guests about what it means for these people as they seek refuge in Canada.
This is pretty severe. It's pretty serious stuff. It's life or death for a lot of people. If they are suspected, they may become persecuted in their country and feel the need to escape quickly. Otherwise, the consequences could be, and the repercussions could be really severe, from threats to their family members being threatened, losing their jobs, being attacked. If they are detained, they could be tortured. And again, they could actually lose their life. They could be killed, according to the state. They could be killed on the street, for that matter, without the state being involved.
That was researcher and activist Nick Mulay. What he's describing now is the reality that many queer people find themselves in, leading them to seek asylum from the persecution of their sexual orientation or their gender identity. It's still illegal for LGBTQ+ people to live openly in 69 countries today, and it's still unsafe to be openly queer in many more. Coming out might put you at risk of state violence, prison time, and in 11 countries today, the death penalty. So what we're talking about today is the most critical coming out story of them all. It's the story of being an LGBTQ+ refugee. For them, coming out quickly shifts from being something that should be avoided at all costs to something that you have to prove in a court of law. In Montreal, Canada. And because I'm involved in the queer community, I wanted to understand what some of my neighbors are going through in order to reach safety in my city. I've spoken with several people who have gone through this experience themselves and who work in this area of migration. I asked them what barriers queer refugees faced specifically in reaching Canada. I asked them what it might feel like to develop a claim for asylum that is so personal, so private in nature. Lauren Young came to Canada 8 years ago from Jamaica and is herself an LGBT-identified refugee. In Toronto, she works as the Senior Program Officer for the Rainbow Railroad, which is an organization that helps LGBT people find urgent safety wherever they are in the world. Young tells me that the largest barrier her clients face in getting to Canada is obtaining a travel visa.
So there's the right to asylum, but then there is this barrier that continues to keep LGBTQI people on the outskirts. Just example, Canada is a safe country. You can make an asylum claim in Canada. And then let's use another example, the Caribbean. If homophobia happens in the Caribbean and it's all over the news, Canada will just sit and say, oh, wow, that's so sad, right? I can't help you. You have to get here. And what is it that we need to get here? Those are the barriers. Because in order to obtain a visa, a lot of countries have their restriction, their regulation. You know, you have to be employed, you have to show a job letter, you have to have money in the bank, you have to, you know, own houses or stuff like that. Or show, in other words, show that once you take this trip, you will go back. Like you have to have something to go back. And that's a predicament for people who are LGBTQ identified. Remember, they're already displaced within their own environment. Some dropped out of school, some experiencing homelessness, joblessness, some dealing with health issues, and there's nobody to help. We help them where they are.
I also spoke with Normalize, Lebanese trans rights activist and LGBT-identified refugee herself in Vancouver. She also works at Rainbow Refugee, another organization that supports LGBTQ+ asylum seekers in navigating the Canadian immigration system. I asked her the same question about the barriers trans and gender non-conforming refugees face in arriving to Canada when they don't have time to spare to go through the formal process of seeking asylum in advance.
I would say one of the main issues or obstacles that gender diverse, non-binary, and trans folks can face before entering Canada would definitely be safety to get a visa to start with. A lot of trans people and a lot of non-binary people, their gender identity doesn't certainly match with how they look like. And sometimes it can put them at risk to go to the visa office and to apply for visas. From a personal experience, I had to apply before I physically started transitioning. So it was a bit, I guess it worked for me because I represented in a certain way that reflected my gender on my passport. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the biggest obstacles that people face. Of course, let's not forget the privilege of being able to have a job so you can finance applying to the visa and you can be able to go and travel and book your ticket on your own. But one of the things I believe that is number one is their gender identity matching how they look like.
So while Young and Lies cite the travel visa as the number one obstacle, what each of them are also pointing out is that financial barriers play a big part in this as well. Now, for those who do make it, upon arrival or shortly after, refugees must disclose their grounds for asylum, that they're persecuted in their home country, and that they're queer in this case. Now, despite Canada being a safe country in general, state borders are not seen as safe places, right? But the fact is that the Immigration and Refugee Board of Canada, also called the IRB, will judge a case by the credibility of a person's story, meaning, is this person really who they say they are? Do they really need the Canadian state's protection? So for this reason, people are expected to be immediately forthcoming, extremely detailed in their disclosures, and to provide as much supportive evidence to their identity, to their experiences of persecution, as they can. But with something so private as sexual and gender identity, how can this affect queer people uniquely? Next, I spoke with Nick Mulay, who researches the social inclusion and exclusion of gender and sexually diverse populations in social policy. He talks about what claiming asylum at the border might feel like for LGBTQ plus refugees, and how the traumas of homophobic persecution can affect their credibility rating from the get-go.
When one understands this from a perspective of someone who's coming from a place for which they were persecuted based on their sexual orientation or gender identity, we have to be realistic about how forthcoming they're going to be about that, right? So even if you have a person in uniform standing before you or seated before you and asking, does this have anything to do with your sexual orientation? You know, and even going so far as to say, do you like women? Do you like men? That can be really invasive. And for a lot of people in the initial interviews, they're going to deny any of that because of where they came from. You know, they may have been tortured for that, right? So there has to be a sensitivity here on how to address that.
And is it addressed sensitively? I wanted to get more clarification on what the claims process is like. So I spoke to Toronto-based lawyer Nicholas Woodward to find out what category LGBTQ plus refugees fall under and what the process is like to build his clients' cases.
The refugee claimants who are making claims based on their sexual orientation or their gender identity, they're claiming under the ground of a particular social group. So sexual orientation and gender identity is considered as that a particular social group under the convention definition.
He's referring to the UNHCR's 1951 Refugee Convention, which describes queer refugees as, in full, people with diverse sexual orientations, gender identities, gender expressions, and sex characteristics, also known as the acronym SOGIESC.
I think one of the biggest challenges and that one of the things that makes these cases different is just the question of how to prove their sexual orientation or gender identity. So at the board, at the Immigration and Refugee Board, when claimants go to their hearings, they have the opportunity to provide documentary evidence to support their claims. And so in some cases, it's hard for LGBTQ refugee claimants to actually have documentary evidence of their sexual orientation. So that's, in every single case, that's always an interesting discussion that we have with all of our clients to brainstorm ways that they can prove their sexual orientation or gender identity. First, I would start by saying that the board members have to consider as evidence the claimant's testimony. So all refugee claimants, as part of their original refugee claim, they have to write out their basis of claim, which are the reasons, like their life story, the reasons why they're making a refugee claim. And so they sign that document and that becomes sworn testimony.
He also tells me that other documentation can range from letters of support from friends, former partners, and family members, to photos at gay pride events, dating app profiles, and conversation screenshots, and proof of involvement in LGBTQ plus community organizations by letters of support from the people working there.
It's not a requirement in any way to provide evidence of like being open or you know being gay in their country of origin. So mm-hmm. in cases where there's just no evidence from before, it's completely okay just to focus on what they have here. And like I said, if they don't have any evidence, if it's really not possible, then it's going to be just a question of providing really credible testimony at the hearing about how they identify.
Right. So has the Immigration and Refugee Board always had this understanding that proving sexual orientation and gender identity can be so hard to prove for people who have had to flee their countries because it was so unsafe to live openly?
I mean, one thing I guess that I would say is that the Immigration and Refugee Board has taken some positive steps in recent years in terms of how it deals with cases involving sexual orientation or gender identity. So in the last decade, the board introduced a guideline called the SOGI guidelines. This guideline, it like sets out particular considerations that all board members have to keep in mind with respect to claimants with diverse sexual orientations or gender identity.
By the way, this revision is called the Chairperson's Guideline 9, and it's been in effect since May 2017. It's basically a guideline that Immigration and Refugee Board members have to follow when making the decisions on any case, and it includes proper terminology on how to identify and speak about queer people, and most importantly, a big section on avoiding stereotypes during evaluations. So whereas in the past, being in a heterosexual marriage, for example, would harm someone's credibility score, the guidelines rightly support that this can still be true for a gay person. Another one that is, for example, trans people would have undergone medical treatment to affirm their gender already, something that even if one wanted to, would probably be impossible in their country of origin as per their seeking asylum.
So I think that's a really positive step, and it sets out things that we've already talked about, like, you know, they have to consider that sometimes there isn't evidence of someone's sexual orientation, or, you know, sometimes this is the first time that people are really talking openly about their sexual orientation, especially with a stranger and like in a position of authority. And so they have to take these kinds of factors into consideration when they're assessing someone's identity.
Right. Would you say that you see the result of that in the court or by the board members?
Yeah, for the most part, in most hearings, I would say that the board members are referring to this guideline, and it's clear that there's been some training done where, you know, they're applying what the guidelines say.
When I asked Norma Lies about her experience putting together her claim and the kinds of documentation she used, she told me that having documentation is quite a privilege for people coming from a place where they can't live authentically.
It can be different from a person to another, because in my experience, I had a lot of documentation and I had a lot of evidence to provide, but for someone else, their evidence might be just one picture or maybe a screenshot from a dating app that they joined, because not all of us have the privilege of being out there or the privilege of experiencing a lot of stuff. We don't have, like, we have to remember that a lot of the refugees that are moving to Canada to seek asylum, not all of them live their authentic lives outside of Canada. Canada can be the first country where they will be able to move and live who they really are. I remember one of my friends back in 2017, when he moved to Canada to apply, he only had one picture of him and his partner back then. And that was the only evidence that he could provide, you know? And he had, once he landed in Canada, he had to go to gay clubs and download a few dating apps, take screenshots, take the receipt from the gay club and attach it as an evidence as well.
When I asked Lauren Young if it's harder for LGBTQ plus refugees to prove their credibility in their case, she said she wouldn't say it's more difficult, but just that this process is uniquely vulnerable and emotionally demanding.
It's very unique for LGBTQI people because, one, they want you to detail from the very moment you realize that you are LGBTQ identified, and so, you know, coming into a new space, not knowing, not familiar with the culture, the food, the clothes, the people, not getting, you know, maybe the right, connected to the right services, not knowing what the process entails, it is frightening, and rehashing your story, rehashing traumas that you've been through, it's heavy, right? And that fear of, I want to tell you my story, but if I tell you my story, people are going to know that I tell you my story and I can't return. And that fear of, you know, am I going to be accepted or not, right? It is not an easy process, but it is doable, right? It becomes challenging also when you try to validate your claim. So they'll ask you for support letters. Okay, you are a lesbian woman. Give me some support letters from friends who can attest to the fact that you are a lesbian woman. And then reaching those friends and actually getting it. I mean, it can be very tedious. Sometimes you don't get any response because persons, depending on where you're coming from, the culture, persons don't want to put their identification or their signature to stuff like that, right? Because of fear. It places them in a predicament where, you know what, I don't care because you're in a safe country, so you can out yourself, but I'm not. And until I am, then I don't feel comfortable writing such a letter. So if you don't have persons to give you that support to validate that you're, it can become frightening, right? And especially coming from countries where, you know, for sure, if you are outed, that's it for you. That's it for your family. Not only you, it places your family who is actually back in that environment in danger, right? The decision makers that work with IRB, I think they're qualified enough and they know what is happening because they read the international news. And actually, they can tell you more what is happening in your culture than you can. What they want you to detail is your personal experience with that and things that, you know, they'll ask you, things that they will ask you for that can validate your claim, which would like, show me a picture with an LGBTQ advocate. Show me screenshots of conversation you have had with previous partner, same-sex partner, previous or current. Show me LGBT screenshots of LGBTQ online groups that you're following. This poses a challenge to persons who don't want to be out, like persons in the Middle East and North Africa. They would not readily have those things on their phone because they have religious police going around. Mm-hmm. And the police can stop them and say, unlock your phone. And that would mean imprisonment. And that can mean death also. So not having those, then how do you determine if this person is who they say they are, right? It becomes challenging. It becomes frightening for the person going through the process. The difference with LGBTQI people is this is personal stuff. Like, you're telling me to tell you that I like girls. You're telling me to prove to you that I like girls. And that is something that people don't really talk about in public spaces or have people read in their story. Oh, I've been with this person. I've been with that person. This person did me this. That person did me that. It becomes personal and it becomes, it is unsettling for a lot of person to kind of rehash that all the time, you know, trying to tell their story. Sometimes you don't remember some of the stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Because you're so preoccupied with thinking about, you know, am I safe? Where am I going to go? And then you're in this new environment. How do I get around? You're navigating so many things, right? You're not familiar with the setting. You're not familiar with the climate. You're not familiar with the food. It is a lot of stuff. And then to navigate that process and do so successfully. But luckily, we have organizations on the ground that help people through those processes, make an application. And then we're thinking about the capacity of the person themselves. Can they read and write? Do they understand English? Do they need an interpreter? Right? Are they struggling with mental health issues that impairs them in remembering, you know, what happened, which one happened first, how it was detailed, because they're asking you to detail every single thing. I had to go back to age 8. And at the time, I was age 36, and I'm thinking, I can't even remember what happened yesterday or what I had for dinner yesterday, right? Because I'm so stressed about just the entire process. It is a lot to deal with.
Overall, what really strikes me about all of this is the fact that LGBTQ plus identified refugees are expected to bear their soul, bear their life story to strangers who don't know you, who don't know your culture, who have an authority position over you at the moment, and who might just see you as a number in their day job, while risking that your life's testimony, since the first moment you knew you were gay, you were queer, through all the trauma that has led you to flee your country, that all of this might not even be enough to grant safety in the end. The truth is, even after arrival, the struggle's not over. This whole journey takes a lot of rehashing that some people don't ever feel ready to do, right? Then there's searching for housing, for employment, while waiting for permanent status, which could take years. What's more, queer refugees often have specific needs that general refugee organizations can't provide for. So in the end, people can be left with this inner tension when seeking asylum, with the understanding that a part of them will always be left behind when they leave home. But the story does not end there. Lauren Young and Normalize both work in organizations that create the sense of community that sparks that magic again of what coming out should feel like. The self-empowerment that declaring who you are to people you care about is meant to give.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Human Rights Magazine. The podcast is brought to you by the Upstream Journal. I invite you to consider supporting the program and the magazine with a contribution through PayPal as you explore other episodes.